This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Central Piedmont Community College was a very different place in 1992. That's the year Dr. Tony Zeis arrived to take over as president. And in those 23-plus years, he championed the idea that Charlotte should be a global hub of commerce. And to move the city in that direction, he positioned the college to be a training ground for jobs in a global economy. He started the Global Competitiveness Summit, bringing to Charlotte speakers from around the world to talk about moving the city forward. He remade the central campus and expanded the school's reach into far-flung parts of the county. We tell you all this because now Dr. Zeis is retiring, and we've invited him to spend an hour reflecting on what he's accomplished, why he wanted to do what he did, and what he sees as the future of community colleges and higher education in a world with rocketing college debt and an increasing need for an educated workforce. So Dr. Tony Zeis, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
You've been there as president for almost 24 years. Did you think when you arrived that you'd stay that long?
Well, no. As a matter of fact, at the time we took the job, my wife was saying that she really wanted to get back to her home state of Texas. I said, well, let's go down and do the Charlotte thing for 4 or 5 years, and then I'll look for a job in Texas. Well, as soon as we got to Charlotte, didn't take very long, we found that we fell in love with the place, and we said, this is it. This is where we're going to stay.
Yeah, we have trees. Does Texas have trees?
No.
I mentioned a lot of the things that you have done, and that just scratches the surface. But what was the mission of the school when you arrived, and what function did it serve then, and how has the mission changed?
Well, actually, it had sort of an unwritten mission of serving the economically disadvantaged and in a way that would help them get the skills to get a job. So that was sort of the unofficial. But the truth is, we didn't have a vision at the time, nor did we have an effective strategic plan. So it was really a wonderful opportunity to start fresh and work with the faculty and the staff and the board and as a matter of fact, the community. We had 37 forums with community groups to say, what do you want the college to become? And then I met with the top 25 CEOs in the community in the first month that I was here and said, what do you think the college should become? I got great input from them, and clearly they wanted it to become a career-focused college with a vision, a broader vision. And that vision, which we set in early 1993, it stays the same today, and that is we intend to become the nation's leader in workforce development. And we have.
So I was going to ask you later on in the conversation if you'd achieved that goal. You have achieved that goal.
We have. In fact, now I'm suggesting to the board it ought to be the international leader in workforce development. And in some ways we have done that too with our apprenticeship programs and all of the new programs we've adopted from Germany and other places.
You're only the third president of that institution, and you've been there the longest of any of the other presidents and longer than many other college presidents in this area have been there. What does that do? What does that longevity do for the institution to have somebody there that long?
Well, you know, as long as they stay enthusiastic and they've still got the energy and that sort of thing, I would say the longer the better. Because that's how you get things done. We set that goal or that vision, be the nation's leader in workforce development. Of course, there are strategies beneath that. But it takes a good while to put things together, get things working the way they should be working, developing the relationships with business and industry and CEOs and with the state and with the federal government, Department of Labor, Department of Education. It just takes time to develop it. So if you really want to accomplish something as a leader in anything, you've got to be there a while and to make that happen.
You bring up an interesting point, because we're a culture that wants instant gratification, and we have a business culture that looks at the next 3 months, the next quarter, and wants instant results so that they can move on, and the long-term strategy is secondary to let's make some more money this next quarter. And then we have a political system in which Congress people are elected every 2 years and the president's elected every 4 years, and they can only serve for 8 years. You can't get any traction going, can you?
You're exactly right. And I've talked about it most of my life. You know, there's power in vision. And, You know, the good book says the people without a vision perish, or in some interpretations, they are unrestrained. In either case, it's chaos. And that's one of the problems. I'm a capitalist because I love our economic system, but there's a weakness in every system. And that's the weakness, which you just pointed out, is it sort of dissuades people from setting long-term visions and long-term strategies. Like China, they have long-term strategies, and they realize that it's the people who control the world economy are going to control. So they look at things long distance. Same with Germany. Germany, they take a look more socialized than we are and politically, but they look at long-term strategies. When there's a dip in the economy, they don't lay people off. They just reduce their hours, and they keep those skilled laborers with them. They don't want to have to go back and say, well, now where do we find them when things get good, you know, get well again? And
why do we do it this way? There are capitalists.
I think you mentioned it. It's because everything's based on quarterly reports. You know, how do we look this quarter? How do we look next quarter?
But in a global economy, and you deal with a lot of German companies.
I sure do.
So in a global economy, aren't they under the same pressures that we are under to perform for the market?
Except their culture is different. They see things in longer terms. Like a 4-year apprenticeship programs. I mean, that's a long-term investment, and it's one in which the apprentices are willing to invest in, and one in which the company is willing to invest in. Whereas in our culture, our companies, although we have several companies just here in Charlotte, American companies-based companies, own companies, that have said, yes, we want to do that. Of course, they generally call it a different name, but most of them are so concerned, Mike, that they're going to have to pay $70,000 a year for an apprentice for 2, 3, or 4 years, and then they're afraid they're going to leave them. So, therefore, that keeps them from training their folks the way they should be trained. So I think it's just a difference in the culture.
How many people are at CPCC today that were there when you arrived? Do you know?
Oh, my. No.
How has it grown? How many people were there when you arrived? How many people work there now?
Oh, gee, that's a hard question. We have about 1,200 full-time faculty and staff, and 15,000 part-time. We have a lot of part-time people who teach part-time classes because we never have enough money to hire all the full-time teachers we need. On the other hand, it's really good to bring people who are working into the classroom because they bring fresh stories, fresh ideas, anecdotes.
Well, earlier this week, and it may have been yesterday, I can't remember because I do so many shows, I can't remember when they were on, but earlier this week, at some place in the not-too-distant past, we did a program on the burgeoning number of adjunct faculty at campuses, mm-hmm. at universities and colleges around the country, and how many of those adjunct faculty members feel abused because they are asked to do almost everything that the full-time faculty is, but without benefits, and a lot of the things that they have to do is on their own time, not the time that they're being paid for in the classroom. And, of course, they have to do all the preparation and the test grading, et cetera, that anybody else has to do, and they feel abused, and some are unionizing around the country. What's the atmosphere at CPCC?
We don't have that, fortunately, and I think the atmosphere there is we have a service attitude, and it took a while to build that culture, but that's part of our culture. It's a core value in our culture is we're there to serve students and our community. We are the community's college, after all. And so I think when you have a culture of, you know what, it's all about serving folks, there's less interest in what's in it for me.
But these people still have to make a living.
That's true. But they also know when they sign up for a part-time class, everything's up front. Here's what we can pay. I wish we could pay more, mm-hmm. but here's what we can pay. And there are no benefits unless you teach, I've forgotten, seems like 30 hours a week or something like that. It's a sad situation. I'd rather have more money and more full-time faculty, but it is what it is.
Is there any way around it? Because on the one hand, colleges are turning to this because of the rising costs of college, and this keeps the costs down. And yet these people, particularly at colleges and universities that are 4-year institutions, they're on a non-tenure track. They're on a course-by-course basis. Things could change in the drop of a hat, and some people have told them don't do this because you can't make a living at it.
Well, I mean, if you're a part-time person, you shouldn't think you're going to make a living as a part-time teacher. It just doesn't work. But most of our teachers, Mike, are working adults.
Right.
And so they're working lawyers, and they come in and teach a paralegal class. They do it because they want to do it. It's fun to do. There are probably some who – I'm sure there are other teachers who are struggling and trying to get a full-time job. And by the way, that's a good way to do it because you start meeting the people in the department and you're a known quantity and they know how well you can teach. And when a position opens, you have a good – probably a better opportunity than someone that they don't know.
You grew this campus from one, which was the central campus, the downtown campus, to six campuses over 23 years, making it one of the largest community colleges in the Carolinas. I kind of thought that it was the largest. Is there a larger college?
Well, actually, it has been. It's been the largest since about 1963. And 2 years ago, Wake County has been growing faster than Mecklenburg County, believe it or not. And their school system surpassed the size of Charlotte's school system several years ago. Mm-hmm. And so the community college, Wake Technical College, surpassed us in full-time equivalent students a year and a half ago by 400 to 600 students. And now we think we still have a higher headcount because we have such a big corporate and continuing education venue where we train people at the workplace, et cetera, to make sure that our companies are competitive and make sure when they expand here. And so we think we're larger by headcount, but they're larger by funded full-time equivalent students.
But as I said, you expanded that the college beyond the downtown campus to six campuses around the county.
Right.
What was the need there? Why did you feel that was necessary to do?
Well, actually, that had started under Ruth Shaw, who succeeded me. And Ruth and the board decided that they really needed to expand from the central campus because the whole county was growing so rapidly and start some satellite campuses. Mm. And so they had fortunately bought two parcels of land before I got here. And so I simply just carried on with that. But I had been privileged to do the same thing when I was president of Pueblo Community College in Colorado before I came here. And so I was very familiar with how to build new campuses and new and so I just carried that same expertise, and we moved forward on that. And we had more people. We had people spending more time in their cars than they did in the classroom. And so we just had to make it a little more convenient.
You mean driving to get to
the center? Driving back and forth, yeah. So we needed to make education more accessible and more convenient, and at the same time, keep it more affordable.
And you're kind of landlocked. I mean, you can only expand so much
exactly.
of the downtown campus because you're at the mercy of who will sell you property.
You're exactly right, and we've been in the middle of that.
Yeah. You did revitalize and remodeled and remade, essentially, the downtown campus.
We've transformed it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
It used to be, when I got there as an applicant in 1992, I heard it had a wonderful reputation as an innovative college, and so that's why it appealed to me. But when I saw that campus, oh, my goodness, I was shocked. It was stucco, and it had, you know, constant maintenance, water problems and mildew problems and all that. And so I said right then, I knew the first thing was we had to build satellite campuses, but as quickly as we could get on that central campus and change the image of the college and make people proud of it, the better we could do it.
Kind of had that utilitarian 1960s cell block feel.
Exactly. Somebody described it the other day as a Soviet architecture.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more with Dr. Tony Zeiss from Central Piedmont Community College on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Belgrave Associates, helping to align marketing and communication strategies with clients' business plans through branding, content curation, digital marketing, and customer relations. Details at belgraveassociates.com. And Live Nation, presenting Daryl Hall and John Oates with guests Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings and Trombone Shorty this Tuesday, May 24th at PNC Music Pavilion, Charlotte. Tickets at livenation.com. Well, on the local news roundup tomorrow, legislative leaders include teacher pay raises in their budget, but at a lower number than Governor McCrory proposed. An update on what Duke Energy is required to do to clean up their coal ash ponds. Back to the legislature, where a political battle over tax cuts reveals a deep divide. And NASCAR is about to set up shop again in the Queen City for Race Week, the All-Star Race, and next week's Coca-Cola 600. Those stories and more on the Weekly News Roundup tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Reim Show, new federal data show U.S. schools are resegregating. The number of high-poverty schools that serve mostly Black and Hispanic children is up sharply. 62 years after Brown v. Board of Education, racial segregation and how to address it.
The Diane Reim Show from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Tony Zeiss is our guest today, the outgoing president of Central Piedmont Community College. He's been there for 23 years. Will be there at least through June and probably longer as they look for a successor, which we'll talk about as we go through this. You remade the downtown campus. We were just talking about that. And it used to be, for those people who don't remember, who didn't live here then, as you said, very Soviet style in its architecture. It's kind of drab and depressing and not impressive. And what you did was turn the buildings, you built new buildings, but some of the, you went back and refaced some of the older buildings and made them kind of classically, almost Georgian in their aspect or in their look. Why?
Well, first of all, it needed to happen. Second of all, I was very familiar with a lot of research. The main researchers on student retention, Noel Levitz is their name, they discovered that one of the great student retention aspects is the environment that you're in. So if you're in an environment you're proud of and it's comfortable, then you tend to remain in that environment. But if you're in an environment you're not proud of and you feel like, oh, I'm just going to the community college, look at this, we're not as good as the universities and all that. So it had to change. And then I talked with Paul Betzel the first month I was here, and he was then the CEO of Presbyterian Hospital. And he had an idea. He said, "Let's clean up this east end. We're gonna remake the hospital and use red brick." And I said, "Perfect. We have to do the same thing. And so let's do it together." And we hired Michael Gallus, as a matter of fact, to help us develop a vision. And today you can see it from Central Piedmont to Presbyterian. It looks great.
Well, Michael is a visionary.
He is. In fact, he has helped us with the Global Vision Initiative, as you probably know.
Yeah. The purpose of the college in 2016 is pretty much the same, although you've broadened that from when you first started out with all these global initiatives that, that you've put in place. But you just said something interesting to me. You said that at one point, oh, I'm just going to a community college. It's not as good as a four-year college. How should Charlottians, Mecklenburg County residents, how should we view Central Piedmont Community?
As the golden gem that it is. I mean, if there's ever an economic powerhouse, it's that college, because we're producing the labor force that attracts the companies that we can attract, and then ultimately drives the prosperity. We're a huge contributor to economic development and prosperity. The other thing is, parents need to understand that, you know, we are focused on really three things, and that is accessibility. We're convenient and open door to all people. Mm-hmm. Affordability, we keep our tuition as low as we possibly can and our fees. And success, and that means all of our programs are relevant. They're tied to jobs. So you're not going to come to us and take major in something for 4 years and pay a lot of money and maybe have your son or daughter go into debt, and then they get out and they can't get a job. You know, Mike, we've had up to 23% of our students are reverse transfers, which means they've already gone through the university, and either they majored in something they didn't like or they couldn't find a job in their field and they come back to us, or they've been laid off and they come back to us. So we feel a tremendous purpose in career education.
In this conversation and in others we've had, we've talked a lot about job development and about getting people ready for the global jobs of the global economy. technical jobs, etc. But do more people come to you for job training purposes than as the first 2 years of a college experience that to move on to a university?
That's a wonderful question. Yes, they do. In fact, only about 30% of our students intend to transfer to universities. Some change their mind after they come to us, but about 30%. The rest of them, they want certifications or degrees to go to work. And that's what it's all about. Now, that includes the arts. When we say workforce development, you've directed our theater over there. We have wonderful theater. We have opera theater. We have two-dimensional, three-dimensional art, you name it. And those folks want to work also. When we say broad workforce development, it's in the broad sense.
Interesting. Because it with the rising cost of college, a lot of young people, I'm told, I wouldn't know because I'm not young, but I'm told that they are using more and more community colleges to get that first 2 years under their belt and then to go off to graduate from a four-year college because it reduces the cost of the education.
And you're so smart to bring that up, and that's a common theme and message that we have to the public. What a great place to start, because our faculty are focused on teaching. They don't hire grad students and all that. They focus on teaching. And so they're going to get high-quality education. We focus on student success and learning, and it's going to cost them a fraction of what it would cost at the university. And, of course, now we got through the legislature. It took a number of years, but all of the public universities accept our students as juniors if they take their first 2 years here. And the same with private universities. We have students transfer to Duke, to Davidson, you name it. They're all over the place.
So all of the courses transfer, the credits
transfer. I shouldn't say that. All the general education courses. Now, if they take welding and the university doesn't teach welding, it's not in their program, well, they won't get any credit for that.
But. So what do you think? I mean, and you may not know the answer to this question. What is the two-year graduation rate for young people who come there, or any people, they don't have to be young, any person who comes there to get those first 2 years so that they can go on and graduate from a four-year institution,
right?
How many actually are successful at the two-year
graduation? I would say about a third of them are successful at finishing 2 years and going to 4 years because, Michael, most of them, as soon as they will go a year, our research shows that they come for a year, they get their grade point average up, their confidence up, and then they transfer. Mm-hmm. So they transfer before they get their two-year program. So we've even developed a process now where we can follow them through public universities if they go there, or any of them. And once they get enough credits to receive the associate degree, we will offer that to them, to give it to them, because they really have earned the credential. They just didn't earn the last half with us.
Right.
And so we're trying to do that, and it's working pretty well. But we would really rather keep them for the full 2 years and let them finish. So they end up almost with a double major if they have a two-year degree here in arts or sciences, and then they finish out at the university.
You mentioned people get their confidence up.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons they come there, maybe because they didn't have a good educational experience and are not ready for college. Talk about that. How many of the young people who come to you, either for job training or to get ready to go to a four-year college, come to you prepared for college?
Actually, if they're adults, they need refresher. Most of them need some sort of a refresher course. But if they're fresh out of high school, there's a high percentage. It's over 50% need developmental education. So we've been working really hard. We brought Bill Gates and his wife to our campus. It was the first community college they'd ever been to about 6 years ago. 5 years ago, and they got very excited on this issue. They said, how many of your developmental education students actually make it through, say, to a degree or a certificate? And the number was very low. And so they gave us funding to develop a new delivery system for mathematics. That's the program that really kills most students' educational dreams.
Killed me.
Yeah. So we developed a competency-based, self-paced, computerized mathematics training for developmental education, or developmental mathematics. And we were the first model to do that with funds from Gates. and the achievement levels of students taking those classes versus the traditional classes was well over 30%. So we knew we had something. And then,
is that because they can work at their own speed?
It is. They can work at their own speed, and the teachers become sort of facilitators of learning. So they're roaming around, and if a student holds his hand up or her hand up, then they're right over there to help them with individual help.
I think I've actually seen this. I'm not sure which building this is in, but I think I was walking through a building over there one day, and there's a bunch of computers in this big open room, and everybody's huddled over their little keyboards.
It's called the Math Emporium.
With a teacher kind of walking through the room.
That happens to be in, as of yesterday, it happens to be in the Zeiss building. And
congratulations.
Thank you very much. The board
do you know that person?
I do. And it was quite an honor and wonderful thing for him to do. But I'm very pleased that Math Emporium is there. And so then we said the other two developmental areas that are troublesome are English and reading. And so the John M. Belk Endowment gave us some funds to develop the same delivery system for math and reading. And it's accomplished now, and we are working the bugs out of it. And so next year we will share that curriculum and that process with the other 58 community colleges in North Carolina and then out to the country.
Are there any other kinds of courses or subject areas that would lend themselves to that kind of work?
Almost all of them, except you might have to have some laboratories. If you can't teach how to rebuild a carburetor online. But you can show them how, but at some point they have to put their hands on it. So basically about everything. As a matter of fact, the college is leading another statewide initiative called Competency-Based Education Model, and that's what it is. You build one they learn one competency, and then they learn the next one, and each competency stacks upon the other one and gives them a certificate, and that builds to another certificate and finally a degree. And so we are working now on mechatronics, which is advanced manufacturing, and the other one is in information technology services. And so there are four colleges working on that, and we're the lead college.
We touched on this earlier in the conversation, and you've been on this program in the past to talk about workforce development and becoming the national leader in workforce development, which you've said you are. And you've done that by setting up all kinds of different programs, apprenticeship programs, which are relatively – it's old school, but it's also new school thought, at least in this country, because we've gotten away from that in the last 200 years. Meanwhile, some people have said that colleges that work to train workers are taking over the training for private companies that used to do those training programs themselves. So we are putting on the taxpayers' back the work of training workers for, I'm just going to pick a company, XYZ. Mm-hmm. Why can't they pay for it themselves? Why don't they do it themselves? Why do they outsource it to you, and why are we paying for it?
I have not heard much of that, but I can see where people would think that way. We think in the opposite, and that is if you want to attract a Siemens, you're going to have to be able to demonstrate that you can train a workforce that meets their standards. And so that's what we did for Siemens. You might recall, I think I told you, we sent our instructors to Germany to be trained by Siemens to come back here to make – and that's how we helped recruit them, among other people, is by saying, look, we'll give you the best trained workforce you can get. And so therefore, that became a wonderful incentive for them to locate, and we've now trained over 1,200 employees for them, and that's been great for Charlotte. And so then they said, well, we want an apprenticeship program. Could you help us start one? And we said, sure. And so we've done that, and that's worked out extremely well. They're in their fourth or fifth class now. And so they said, you know what? We don't need a training division. You're a training division. We'll just have some liaisons work with you. And so we said, that's terrific. And then when we had our last fundraising campaign for the college, I went to the CEO of Eric Spiegel, North American CEO of Siemens, and we've been on several speaking circuits together. I said, Eric, we need your software. Siemens has the very best software for mechatronics, advanced manufacturing, in the world. And I said, we need that because we're recruiting more manufacturing plants here because we want to export more and be more of a global economy. And he said, done. And Michael, I thought, Well, I knew it was very expensive. I thought, well, it might be an $8 or $10 million ticket that he's going to give to the college. It was $32 million. So, I mean, yes, we've become their training division, and yes, we used some state money to train 1,200 people, but they moved this wonderful plant here, and they're still helping the community. $32 million worth of software is amazing.
Wow. Chicken and egg question. Which came first, the desire to become a global leader or a national leader in mm-hmm. workforce development, or the desire to make Charlotte a hub? Because I know this is one of your things, a hub for global commerce. Which
Perfect.
Came first?
Well, the first was the national leader in workforce development. I knew that we had to become really good at that if we were going to go the next step in our economic progress and develop some long-term vision and strategy to become this global hub of commerce. So the becoming really good at what we do nationally became first. And once we did that, that's how we partnered with our friends in Baden-Württemberg in Germany. And do you know that we signed an agreement with them? They're a government entity that writes the tests and delivers the tests to apprenticeships in Germany. And those apprentices have to pass those tests, so they give certifications that they know what they're doing in manufacturing. We have an agreement signed several years ago where Central Piedmont is now the only college that can teach and confer German certifications in advanced manufacturing. That gives us a real advantage when we're recruiting manufacturing plants from Germany, and an advantage for our students who want to get jobs in one of the 200 German plants in the Charlotte metro region.
But if I read a material that I read yesterday about you correctly, you have this vision of Charlotte becoming this global hub of commerce. Does that vision come from you? Does it come from business leaders who see an opportunity for Charlotte in doing that? Does it come from companies that are coming to you because you have this reputation and maybe we'll give you a shot? Where does it come from?
Well, actually, the first person I talked to was Chase Saunders, who's a former Superior Court judge. In fact, you had us on one of your programs mm-hmm. a couple of years ago. And then Michael Gallas, who's a great visionary, and that's what he does. He develops regions economically, Singapore, New York City, you name it. And then a little later, John Gallas of Charlotte Biz Magazine. And so we said, you know what? We know we need a vision. So Chase and I began to talk to key leaders, and they all confirmed, yes, we need a broader vision, and yes, it needs to be global. So then, you know, I don't have a lot of power, but I have the power of convening. And so we held a global competitiveness summit with the express purpose of talking about an economic vision for Charlotte and the Charlotte Metro. And out of that, some 180 people came, mainly business leaders, some government leaders, and they participated in a process where we adopted the vision together. So it wasn't just my vision or any one person. It was that. And then from there, we developed a strategic plan. We started moving forward. J.P. Morgan Chase, they're all about that. They've given us three grants. The latest one, they gave us the money to do two research studies, one with the Brookings Institute, to compare our global assets with peer metropolitan regions around the world. Mm-hmm. And they did that. And so anyway, we've made really great progress.
And where do we stand at the moment, in 5 seconds or less?
We stand well. We are the fastest growing exporter in America.
Dr. Tony Zeith with us. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts. The Mavericks are back with a blend of rockabilly, Latin, and country music Sunday at Knight Theater. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. And from Mille Lacs Jewelers, the diamond specialists dedicated to teaching customers about diamonds, pearls, and gemstones to make an educated decision. Located at the Arboretum, MilleLacsJewelers.com, a diamond importer. Well, on the Diane Rehm Show, new federal data shows that U.S. schools are resegregating. The number of high-poverty schools that serve mostly black and Hispanic children is up sharply, 62 years after Brown versus Board of Education, racial segregation in schools and how to address it, the topic of the conversation, in 20 minutes on The Diane Rehm Show. Now's your shot to talk to Tony Zeiss, and you can do it by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or reaching us through Facebook or Twitter, and we're coming right back.
From the Marketplace desk of Things You Didn't Know, Grey's Anatomy is wrapping up its 12th season as ABC's number one drama.
It's not common. We don't have that long of a history with the possibility of moving audiences in this way.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the special sauce behind Grey's success, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Tony Zeiss is our guest, the president of Central Piedmont Community College for the past 23 years, has announced his retirement. He's put a date on it. They've asked him to stay a little longer until they find his replacement, and he's agreed to do that. You say that Charlotte's economic pillars today are being the number one energy hub in the country, the number two financial center in the country, and the number three in world-class healthcare facilities and service, which we've done a lot of shows on in recent months. But you also talk about the importance of higher education, and our state has come under criticism recently for how it's treating higher education, cutting funds, not just higher education, but cutting funds to public education, cutting funds to higher education, and almost having an anti-educational bent in certain areas of policy making. And it's happening around the country, too. It's not just here. It's partially responsible for the rising student debt load because they've cut funding to public institutions, and the brunt of it is now falling on individuals who are going there. Is government, our citizens, taking the right approach to higher education, or are we cutting off our nose to spite our face?
You know, it comes back to our prior discussion about taking the time to plan and have a vision of where we're going. And I think in many cases we're short-sighted because legislators are facing the great pressure of not enough money to handle every social program or every educational program around. And so they're pressed and they have to make priorities. And they think, well, let's just take care of this year. And so they can raise their tuition. Well, they'd raise their tuition, and suddenly that happens the next year and the next year and the next year. And pretty soon they're complaining, well, university's tuition's too high. Well, you're right. In fact, even at the community college level, when I came here in 92, 93, the state legislature funded 70% of our operating budget. Today it's 42%. Something has to happen. So we've had to become more entrepreneurial. At the same time, we've had to raise some fees and raise some tuition over the – although we don't get to keep our tuition, but the state raised our tuition. So nevertheless, it went up for the consumer. We're very concerned about it because we can't stay on this trajectory. Right now, what students need and what they want, and families, is they want accessible – affordable and successful educational experiences in higher education. Those are the three things we should be working about. And one way to do it, and it's emerging, 24 states already allow community colleges to teach applied baccalaureate degrees. That means what's happening is employers in certain areas are beginning to demand more higher education. Not more technical education, but more higher education in technical programs. So sign language, paralegal, dental hygiene. Some of those programs now they're saying, could you add the next two levels? And so these 24 states have allowed community colleges to do that. You know what that does, Michael? That gives access to economically disadvantaged students to baccalaureate degrees. Why wouldn't you want to do that? Of course, you know, human nature says that, you know, there's going to be resistance to any sort of change, and generally universities don't like that. Although they're full, I mean, they're full in enrollments, but I think that's inevitable. That's going to be one of the future programmatic issues that's going to face North Carolina, as it's already faced many other states.
You just mentioned having to become more entrepreneurial, and I think that one of your institutional values is also innovation, and you've put together this president's entrepreneurial team to foster and reward innovation from faculty and staff. What has that brought, Colin?
Oh, that's a good question. It's called we formalized it, and I knew early on when we had that 2001 recession, I said, you know what? And then the state began to not fund us as much as they could. Now, they're not doing it in an egregious way. They just don't have enough money. So it's, do we raise taxes? What do we do? And so we work hard to get what we can out of the state, and certainly the county commission's been very good to us. But we also work hard at raising money philanthropically through the foundation and through grants from the state and the federal government and private foundations. But what you're raising now is there a way that we could be more entrepreneurial and provide fee-for-service opportunities? And we developed an organization called the CPCC Services Corporation that allows us to do that. So it's a separate nonprofit corporation. All the net profits have to go to the college, and so we look at the greatest capital any organization has is the intellectual capital of its people. And so I'm going, I've got all these great faculty and staff people, and they got great ideas. Let's see what sort of ideas they've got. Let's put it together. So we formed the president's entrepreneurial team. It became pretty soon a core value of the college, and people are saying, if I want to start some sort of a business, if you will, or some sort of a service or a free service or a consulting service in my field, then we help them start that. And we'll give them release time. And then they will do that. They will get a percentage of whatever profits are there. Their department gets a percentage of profits because they need new equipment and all that all the mm-hmm. time. The rest goes into a reserve fund so that when we run out of funds to hire more teachers because we have more enrollments than we can handle, we will simply say we'll sweep 100,000 or 200,000 or whatever it happens to be from that, and it gives us flexibility where we can help ourselves.
And innovation obviously comes from trial and error and success and failure and the sharing of ideas. So how do you set up that environment that encourages taking risks but removes the fear from those risks?
Yeah, I think the first thing was to put together the president's entrepreneurial team. We brought in 30 of the top really, really innovative people that we knew about. We invited them to come in, and that instantly, and then I meet with them on every meeting. And it sort of became prestigious, or one of them belongs. So a third of them go off every year. And so they go in for 3 years, and then every year it rotates. So now, after 15 years, it has become a core value because so many people have gone through it. Now, you don't have to do it, but we had one teacher, for instance, who said, my Hispanic English as second language learners are not learning fast enough. I think if I supplemented it with a television program that could both teach them how to assimilate in the culture, how to get pay for their utility bills, how to get a driver's license, how to come to Central Piedmont and register. And so she set up this program, television program, with our TV folks, and it got so popular, other schools began to buy it, and then McGraw-Hill bought it. Mm. And so we have a research department. They said, we want to do contract research. We could do contract research. And so the contract researchers are paid with the Services Corps, and they started their own business, and now they're producing all kinds of research from all over the country. And that's helped our own capacity for research, but also it generates some revenue.
And does this play into what you're doing with business? Is this the kind of thinking, this kind of attitude that businesses want from new employees? Critical thinking,
yes,
entrepreneurial attitudes, et cetera.
Very astute. Yes, exactly. Another case would be you've been to the Harris Conference Center. Mm-hmm. It's the only business conference center in Charlotte. We did that because we stay close to business, and 40% of our students are in corporate and continuing education. And so they said, we need this. So we built that, and now they use it. They see we teach, what do you call it, events planning.
Mm-hmm.
out there. So they know that if they have an events planner that's been through some of our training, they're going to have these business-minded, critical thinking skills, et cetera.
Let me share with you some things that have come in from listeners as we've been talking. Gus emails, one of Tony's strengths is his willingness to be visible and accessible on campus and in the community as the voice and face of CPCC. Many of us hope that he and Mrs. Zeiss will remain members of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg community by declaring North Carolina their new Texas. Is that the plan?
Absolutely. We would not leave Charlotte. It's home. Our son and his wife live here. Another son lives two hours away. And no, this is our home. And we're going to stay very active in helping this community. We love this community. I'll stay active in the Global Vision Initiative. Obviously, you know, we have 185 key leaders in 28 counties working on that initiative. It's not just Charlotte. It's all the way down to Greenville and Spartanburg, and it's quite an exciting thing. But we're going to stay in Charlotte, and we'll work on all things historical. We love history, as you well know.
Right.
So it's exciting.
I was going to bring this up much later in the conversation, but you brought it up. You love history. And I know that periodically you like to dress up in period costumes.
I do.
Are you a reenactor? What period?
Well, mostly Revolutionary War. Alan Tate got me into that. I've written four books on the United States war between the states, Civil War. Mm-hmm. And Alan Tate kept saying, Tony, you're in the wrong war. You're in the wrong war. Well, I grew up in Indiana, so obviously I didn't know anything much about Revolutionary War till I got here. And he tutored me, and I just fell in love with everything Revolution. So,
is that why Captain Jack is down there on the campus?
That's exactly why Captain Jack is on the campus. That and Chase Saunders thought we needed to get a statue to him somewhere. And then that's developed the Trail of History. So now we've got six statues on there. We've got three more coming. We can talk about that in a moment if you want. But I wrote a book called Backcountry Fury. And it's about a 16-year-old South Carolina boy named Thomas Young who fought at Kings Mountain and Cowpens and other places. He's a remarkable guy. He wrote his memoirs. And so I wrote this novel for young adults. And I'm pleased to say it won a national gold medal. Anyway, I said, if we're going to keep history alive and help our young people understand what, you know, the founding fathers did and what sacrificed for our country, then I need to be talking about it. So I talk in first person as Thomas Young. I'm in my deep 60s, and so I just reminisce about the battle and his battles. It's great fun.
Tell me you play a fife. Go ahead, tell me.
I don't play a fife.
Just check.
Yeah, I don't do that. I also, by the way, I also play Captain Jack. I do that. I'm Captain Jack.
Diane on Twitter writes, don't forget to ask Dr. Zeiss about the importance of private philanthropy to CPCC's success.
Absolutely. We couldn't get along without our donors. So from 2001, when we had that recession, and I realized we had to become more entrepreneurial and we had to raise more money on our own, then that's fine. If that's what we have to do, we have to do it. And I will tell you, private donors in Charlotte are so generous, and they have great hearts. And I don't ever think that I'm selling something when I'm raising funds. I truly believe I'm giving people the opportunity to do something meaningful for somebody else. And so I tell them, I said, listen, when you meet your scholarship recipient, if that's what happens to be, when you meet your first scholarship recipient, you're going to want to give us more money, and they do.
Mm. You get more than you give. I mean, from that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Rosemary on Facebook, what Dr. Zeiss has done for CPCC in Charlotte is remarkable. I would ask, however, about the place of foreign languages in the plans. English-speaking students would benefit from more extensive language experience in German, French, Japanese, Russian, and Chinese. And the internationals who have made Charlotte their home need more support in good placement in academic ESL classes rather than wandering through the coursework designed for students whose first language is English.
I don't know about the wandering, but I'll certainly check into that. But we give our first two English as second language classes are free, and then everything after that they have to pay for. But we're constantly trying to help the international community. You know, for the last probably 10, 12 years, the student government president has been a foreign national,
yeah,
because they love this college. We have 166 countries represented by our foreign students, and so we love our and foreign students. She makes a great point, though. The demographics are changing rapidly. The more we can get our own U.S. citizens to understand and their parents to understand the importance of learning a foreign language, the better. I just got back from taking a delegation from Charlotte to our German partners. And by the way, Commissioner, Chairman of the County Commission, Trevor Fuller, and other notables went with us. It was terrific. But I was thinking everything was done in English in Germany, and most of them speak three languages, some of them more than that. Right. And so we're handicapped, and she's exactly right. We need to put more emphasis on that.
We're going to run out of time here, and we only have 2 minutes left. But a couple of years ago, you bought WTVI. You assumed the responsibility of operating that television station, which had fallen into hard times. What made you think that CPCC, and I know that you have a degree in radio and television and owned radio stations prior to your college experience, but what made you think that the college would benefit from taking over a failing television operation, and have you turned it around?
Well, the first thing is I value public television and public radio, and I was general manager of public radio and public television, and so I had that in my background, and I knew that I knew the value that it brings to community, so I couldn't stand the thought of seeing WTVI go black. And so I began to think about, you know, the other thing is we were already teaching broadcast classes.
And had a cable channel.
And we were getting ready to remodel a building for $5 million to build broadcast studios so we could go full bore with that program. And what better studio to have than a live studio at WTVI? So it just made sense. All the stars came together and said, so now we have a good broadcast production technology program out there. It's going great guns. We're quite excited about it. We hired a wonderful manager, Amy Burkett. I'm sure you've met her. And they just won their first Emmy since since the college owns WTVI. We're quite pleased about that. And that's with Carolina Impact Show. In fact, it happens to be her show. And we're doing well, and we're in the black.
That's good news. Are you on the search committee for your replacement?
No, I'm not. I'm not on that search committee, but I'm an advisor.
I bet you are. Dr. Tony Zeiss, president of Central Piedmont Community College. Thank you for the hour.